like me, you probably have a closet full of local band merch. Whether you know it or not, a lot of that band merch is probably made by Divine Shirt Company right here in Winnipeg. Divine Shirt Company has made all of the Grey Witch Police merch, from our hoodies to our toques to our t-shirts. And if you're looking to get anything done, like screen printing, embroidery, graphic design, digital printing, go to see Divine Shirt Company at divineshirtcompany.ca and tell them Witch Police Radio sent you.
One of our colleagues, Sam Thompson, who, if you saw him, you'd sort of right away assume he was a hippie.
All right, welcome to Witch Police Radio. I'm back with a guest who hasn't been on the show for a few years, but I feel like you're sort of a regular listen for me. I've definitely been, you know, your albums have been in rotation over the years since I first talked to you and sort of first stumbled upon your music. So it was very cool to hear you had a new record out, closing out the year with a new Uncle Sinner album. And I figured the best way to start this off is if you want to introduce yourself and just give some background about what you do as an artist for people who aren't familiar with your music.
Okay. Hi, I'm Uncle Sinner. My real name is Mike, but that doesn't matter. I do sort of like a revisionist folk music. It's all based in the blues or the roots of the blues, but with some like elements of, you know, white American songs as well, you know, like fiddles. And I mean, I play the banjo, although that's an African thing.
Yeah,
as well. So basically, there is the odd original tune, but a lot of it is me taking traditional tunes and rewriting them and revising them so that I can sort of relate to them a little bit better. And sometimes it's like exploring darker themes of death or even toxicity. But there's like a sort of hyper postmodern awareness to all of it. That sort of sounds very up my own arse. I don't mean to sound that way, but.
No, I like how you said sometimes there's a death theme, because it seems like that kind of permeates a lot of your whole discography more than just sometimes.
Yeah, sure. But there are like other things. I mean, like there's a lot of songs that are about relationships and struggles within, or, you know, just the sense of dread and utter helplessness. So it's, you know, it's out in time for Christmas.
Yes, very, very cheery, very holiday spirit. Yeah, yeah. So how long has this one been in the works? Because I'm trying to think of when your last record came out, and it's been at least 3 years by now, right?
It was 5 years
ago.
Like Trouble of This World was released in March of 2020. So right around the time when the world shut down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The album came out, and then a week later, everything was shut down due to the pandemic. And before that was another 5 years for Let the Devil In. So that's about like how often they come out. It started, I wasn't sure that I was going to do another one, but then the song sort of drifted into my head in late April or early May. And I was like, because I didn't have like, I like to have like at least one original song. Like, you know, Uncle Sinner's most popular song is an original tune called Let the Devil In. That's sort of like a Tom Waitsian exploration of like what sin can mean in a secular context. Again, that sort of sounds too thinky. But anyway, so now I had a song and you know, I have like over 5 years, I get enough songs that I'm interested in doing, that I had just enough material for another album. And, you know, people, you kind of want to, I never know if there's going to be another album. So, every time I do something, I'm like, oh, this is like as best, this is as good as I can possibly do. And maybe it won't happen again. And to be okay with that. If this is the last one, and I'm not saying that it is, but if it is the last one, I think I'm pretty proud of it. And I think it's as good as I can do.
Yeah, well, that's a good mindset to have, I think, when you've just released something. I mean, you know, it would suck to be the opposite, where you put this out and be, oh, shit, I'm not really a fan of this.
Just like releasing progressively shittier albums. Yeah. I mean, that is kind of the progression for, like, artists as they age, generally, not universally, but generally. And
yeah, there are a few examples of people, you know, bucking that trend, but for sure, it is a thing. Yeah. So,
You know, people really liked my second album a lot. They didn't love, like, Trouble of This World as much, and that's okay. Like, those were the songs that I needed to make at the time, and I understand that. It's not always going to resonate with people, and there are things that I would do differently, of course, you know, but, you know, if this is to be my end, then I would have it be such an end as to be worthy of remembrance,
for sure, yeah. Well, one thing that I thought of while you were talking here about sort of, you know, having the material to put out a new record. Obviously, like you said at the beginning, you're taking through a lot of traditional songs, reworking them. You have originals kind of spattered in here and there, but what you're doing is a little different from the typical person I interview on the show, where it's, you know, 95% original music. And so I imagine the process of, you know, a completely unrelated artist putting their stuff together for a record is a little different, because you're not only, you know, reworking these songs, but you're sourcing them in the first place, right? You're finding these songs that appeal to what you do. So when you're looking for some of these old songs, which some of them are, you know, 100 years old, maybe more in some cases, how do you determine which one is going to fit your style? Like, what are you looking for, I guess, with these traditional songs in order to be an Uncle Sinner remake or whatever you want to call it?
Yeah, it's hard to describe, but, like, you kind of know it when you find it. And so some of the songs are songs that I've known about for years, like Keep Your Lamb Trimmed and Burning. Like, I listened to Blind Willie Johnson when I was 14 years old. You know, I've lived with that song for a long time, and I've even lived with that arrangement since my, you know, early 20s. I was playing it that way. I just never really recorded it that well before. But there are other ones that, you know, I don't listen to, like, the sort of archival folk music a lot, but I, you know, my son does. And so, like, he sent me Everybody Wants to Know How I Die. And that's how I learned about it. And soon as I heard it, I was like, okay, this needs to be expanded upon. This is perfect. I can sing this. I can play it. I've got ideas for a banjo. I got ideas for a slide guitar on this. And so it only had, like, one verse, and I added verse 2 and verse 3, and like, that was the process there.
Well, and that one, I mean, just the song title alone seems like it fits your whole thing too, right? I mean, it's a perfect Uncle Sinner song title, at least.
Yeah, and you know, the original artist would have meant, like, How I Died, you know, like, this is, like, someone speaking to you from beyond the grave.
Right.
Like, you know, where are all these people when I was dying? But I really like this sort of present tense. I left it in as the present tense because, you know, I really like that idea that we are constantly, like, we're going dormant or dying and then being reborn. I mean, it's part of life in Winnipeg, right? Like, right now we're shut down and dormant, and you know, we've got, you know, evergreens, but that's about it. And but then, you know, spring will roll around, and life happens again.
That brings up an interesting question then, is does being here contribute to the type of music you play? Because there's a bleakness, I mean, for a large part of the year. But I love this city, I'm sure you do too, but there's definitely a dark period that we're sort of in right now, or we're heading right into. Does that kind of vibe contribute to sort of the tone of what you're doing or what you're looking to play?
It does, although in this case I wasn't as inspired by, like, that fallow period that is winter, sort of dormant, like, let's get cozy and rewatch Twin Peaks or whatever vibes that we get, because I started it in the album in the spring, and part of, like, my mental health routine is to just go out across the street. There's a beautiful trail that winds along a creek for a couple of kilometers, and it's all wild, and there's different things that bloom at different times, you know, different wildflowers. Like, we live in a very fertile place.
We do.
So the recording process, I'd be doing a lot of electric guitar at first, And that would correspond to like certain things that were blooming. And then, you know, and playing electric guitar, I ended up ripping like one of my fingernails, and I can hear it on the recording. I'm not going to tell you where, but if you listen close, you'll be like, oh, I wonder if that's where he ripped his fingernail, which meant that I couldn't play banjo. So the banjo, sure, you know, came along a couple weeks later, and that corresponds with like a different sort of bloom. And, you know, like the percussion happens throughout, but it was just this process. And like, even like into late fall, you still have things that are, they're blooming, like yellow ox eye or whatever. I'm not a botanist, but yeah, like, it was great to just like, there was all these like cycles in the album, and they sort of corresponded with different things that were blooming at the time. And once everything was finished and I'm mixing, there's still life out there. Like there's still, even in November, you know, yeah, when things are pretty much done on the album, you get the odd like little tree in the undergrowth that still has green leaves. And I just chuckle to myself about the impetuousness of youth. You know, but like everything's kind of shut down now, and we're up, it's all sort of retreated, and the album's done, and I don't know, it just seems fitting. It just seemed like to fit within the life cycle of a season in Manitoba.
Everybody wants to know how I die, how I die. Everybody wants to know how I die. Everybody wants to know how I die. I was laying in the sick bed, didn't come to visit me. Now they're gonna take me to the graveyard. Everybody wants to follow me. Everybody wants to know how I die, how I die, how I die. Everybody wants to know how I die. Everybody wants to know how I die. Preacher wants to know how I die, how I die, how I die. Well, the preacher wants to know how I die. Everybody wants to know how I die. All the gamblers want to know how I die, how I die, how I die. All the gamblers want to know how I die. Everybody wants to know how I die. And when I get to the graveyard, 100 people by my side, singing songs of revelation and how the body is born to die. Everybody wants to know how I die, how I die, how I die. Everybody wants to know how I die. Everybody wants to know how I die. Well, my brother wants to know how I die, how I die, how I die. Well, my brother wants to know how I die. Everybody wants to know how I die. Everybody wants to know how I die, how I die, how I die. Everybody wants to know how I die. Everybody wants to know how I die. All the junkies want to know how I die, how I die, how I die. All the junkies want to know how I die. Everybody wants to know how I die. Everybody wants to know how I die, how I die, how I die. Everybody wants to know how I die. Everybody wants to know how I die.
Do you think, I mean, I don't know if this is even an answerable question, but do you think it would sound different if you lived somewhere else? If you lived somewhere that didn't have such a drastic sort of life and death cycle of seasons, do you think that would have affected it? I mean, like, well, I don't know, if you lived in the desert or something where it was just hot all the time and there was...
I think it would affect me so that I wouldn't be as preoccupied with, you know, death and rebirth, which is also, you know, I'll say tangentially, like, relapse and recovery, you know?
Sure,
and
sure.
There's that in it as well, you know, just going fallow for a while. And it's not always a good thing, but, you know, it's something that happens to us in winter.
Definitely.
I don't know.
Definitely, yeah.
Sorry.
No. This all makes sense. It's clicking in my head anyway. Obviously, a lot of the material you're doing has very spiritual background. I mean, a lot of this music from back then that you're playing, and just a lot of that old blues and associated genres in general is very church based and very in a nice bleak way, right? A nice depressing kind of the devil shows up a lot and that kind of stuff.
It's right on the cover.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Right. So, I mean, how do you sort of feel about that? Because that style of music, I mean, obviously there's still religious music of all different religions that's existed in various styles over the decades. But this stuff is a very specific, very like almost God-fearing kind of vibe that they had at the time these were made. Do you think that stuff is very, very, I don't want to say stuck, but like specifically associated with one era? Because you don't hear a lot, I mean, maybe I'm just listening to the wrong stuff, but I don't hear a lot of stuff that has that kind of darkness to it as far as people talking about their faith these days, at least not so starkly.
Yeah. Well, certainly like some of the older stuff that I did, like When Jesus Comes, is very much like nunchuck Jesus coming to kick ass.
And
there's a sort of insane glee to that. If I'm not coming from a Christian space.
Right. No, either am I. Listening to it, I get it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but on this one, you know, like I start out with hymns, but like those hymns say things like, you know, he lives and does within me dwell. So like within thinking of God as like something that's inside of us, you know, like whatever that is, whatever, you know, you could call it the light, or if you're a Quaker, or I don't know, just love. Or kindness and just the connection between people. Like, so that's, I think the hymns on this song mostly speak to a kind of secular faith.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that's what I like about some of it too, is that there is like, I mean, not that I'm some expert on Christian music, so I'm definitely not, but I feel like a lot of more modern stuff has this really obnoxious, we're not worthy kind of thing where it's all just praising. Whereas all of this older stuff has the human elements, like someone is struggling and their faith is referenced in that context rather than just, let's just be glorifying this dude forever. You know, I think the struggle part of it is what appeals as a non-religious person. Like, you know, I didn't grow up with any of that stuff. And I think that in a lot of genres of music, I that stuff resonates more with me. The people talking about spiritual issues from a human perspective rather than from a just glorifying whatever deity perspective.
Yeah, and I do make little changes. They're subtle, but they're meaningful to me. Like the last song is "The Dying Californian," and the actual line, it's about, you know, this person is dying. He's about to be like buried at sea, presumably with some cannonballs in the winding sheet to like weigh the body down, and you know, the line in the song, according to the Shape Note hymn book, like there's a hymn book, like Antioch, Rocky Road, and Dying California, and they're all in that book. Although I've, you know, Rocky Road, I changed a lot of the lyrics to, but in Dying Californian, there's a sense of like almost like a same sex relationship of like intimacy, and you know, you're gonna miss me in your birth, you know, and my body will be, you know, underneath the ocean's briny surf. And the original line later on is like, I know that he does nothing wrong, like capital H, like Jesus.
Yeah, yeah.
Jesus does nothing wrong, so I'll be right. I changed it to like, I know that I've done nothing wrong, which could be crazy. Like that could be a crazy thing to say, you know, in the sense of like, everything I do is gold. But in the sense of this particular song, I thought like, the love that I showed is, you know, there's nothing wrong with my love, especially if there is like sort of homoerotic overtones in that, like that makes it interesting to me. And even though like I'm just like allied with that, and that's not part of my life, like I can still relate to the sense of like, I loved who I loved and I didn't do anything wrong. And I don't regret loving the people I loved, you know, like I am who I am. And, you know, so that's that's a way that I can connect to a religious song. And plus, you know, I love the fiddle at the end. It sounds like a Civil War hymn or something like that.
Yeah, for sure.
Go to sleep, little baby. Go to sleep, little baby. Your mama's gone away and your daddy's gonna stay. Didn't leave nobody but the baby. Go to sleep, little baby. Go to sleep, little baby. Everybody's gone in the cotton and the corn. Didn't leave nobody but the baby. Go to sleep, little baby. Go to sleep, little baby. Sugar in the tea and the sweet morphine. Gonna bring a bottle to the baby. Don't you weep, pretty baby. Don't you weep, pretty baby. She's long gone with the red shoes on. Gonna need another loving baby.
What you just described is probably even an older song format than what you're doing with the spiritual stuff, right? That idea that idea of love and everything, and that's those songs have existed forever too. So I mean, it's kind of almost predating the Jesus stuff by taking it in that direction.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah,
I was looking at the I was going to say liner notes, but I don't have a physical copy yet. I will buy one, but I was looking online and
Well, if I'm ever in like fucking St. James, I'll just drop one off.
Cool,
I think that's you're roughly there. I don't want to dox
location. I'm in that vicinity. Yeah. But I noticed that you on a few of the songs, you've got someone playing bass that was not obviously here doing that.
Uh-huh.
So what's the story there? I mean, is this someone you've worked with before? Or?
Yeah, that's Slack Eye Slim. He does like skeleton Western music, you know, very spaghetti Western, you know, a skull with a cigarette playing on top of a tumbleweed, sort of sepulchral voice to him. And he and I, like, he's part of like the death country subgenre that I get lumped into sometimes.
Yeah.
And we ended up doing a benefit together for Navajo and Pueblo people who are really hard hit by the pandemic. And so I met him that way and we just became friends. And I ended up one time I, you know, drove up from Phoenix, Arizona, up to his place. He lives near the Four Corners.
Okay.
So I call it Four Coffins, Colorado, because he's on the Colorado side of the Four Corners. And I spent some time with him. We went into like southeastern Utah, and we just became friends. And he played bass on the Star Thistle album.
Okay, cool,
And he played he plays bass on like six or seven of the songs on this album, and he's just got a good intuitive sense of what the song needs.
I guess the reason I'm curious about his involvement in it is because the rest of the project seems very much like a one-man show. You know what I mean? You're playing everything, you're singing, you're involved in the production side. And then so I know he's not the only person who has contributed to the record, but he's on a lot, like you said, a lot of the songs. How do you sort of incorporate someone like that, especially if they're not recording with you in Winnipeg, right? I mean, how do you sort of fit that into the whole overall sound? Just because everything else is so you.
Well, I mean, it's just one of the gifts of technology is that we can do that. We can collaborate with people, and you know, I can just send him the file, and he can play along with the file and send the bass track back to me. Like, it is not all me. Like like two people from a choir I sing in, you know, add harmonies on a couple of the songs. Person I work with added drums on a couple of tracks, which is very exciting for me.
That is cool.
It was super fun to do. It's like My Babe was very hard to do, but very fun to do. Because I ended up doing it all sort of backwards. Normally you lay down the drums first and the bass and then like the instruments, but like I basically started with the banjo, and so everything had to be sort of in time with a metronome or it was going to go off the rails. Anyway, and fiddles and all that. But I don't know. It was just, I work with, they're mostly outsiders apart from Jeremy on fiddle. Like, it's all outsider music. Slack Eye Slim, like, he does have a following and fans, but we're not part of the music industry. We don't make a living from it. We just do it because we love to do it. And that, you know, not saying that people who aren't professional don't also do it because they love to do it. It's just like we're just not inside the industry, really.
No, that makes complete sense.
Yeah.
Where can people hear this? I mean, you know, obviously it's out at the time we're recording this. It's out in the world now. And as you know, there's millions of places people get music these days. Where would you want someone to find this this record if they were to check it out?
I mean, I'm perfectly happy with people just streaming it on whatever they use for streaming. And then if you don't pay for Apple Music or Spotify, I mean, it's out on YouTube. You can stream it. You can do all that stuff for free if you're willing to put up with commercials. They can download it from my Bandcamp site. You can pay for it or you can not pay for it. It's up to you, really. And if people want like a physical thing, like I had 100, I think, digipacks made, and it was a little trickier this time because I had to pay for royalties. A few of them were, recent enough, like, you know, Gillian Welch, you know, deserves to get songwriting credit for all the verses that she had to. Added to Didn't Leave Nobody But the Babe, and you know, ditto John Lee Hooker, and My Babe was a Willie Dixon tune. He wrote that, so like I have to pay the songwriters. I haven't done that before because in the past I've just used stuff that's so old that it's in the public domain.
That's a weird thing to think about. I mean, I guess a lot of these people are doing similar things to what you're doing too, right? Like, I mean, they're taking an old song and adding to it, like you said, with those verses on the one song, and then you're adding to that. And so it's kind of a cool, weird little, like game of telephone with all of these old songs where it just, someone might hear your cover and then 20 years from now and then do their own version of yours. And I kind of like that.
But they won't pay me.
No, they won't. Probably not. You know, obviously at the time we're recording this, it's the end of December, coming up very soon. Do you have anything planned in the new year as far as shows or things like that to sort of get the word out about this record?
Not really, no. I mean, if I have this like idiot philosophy, you want to hear it?
Sure, let's go over it.
It's just like, if it's good, people will find it. I know that's an oversimplification, and I know that there's lots of good music that doesn't get found by people, and you know, even in popular media, guys like Nick Drake didn't get any respect when he was alive, and now we realize like how amazing he was. But yeah, in general, like I will probably in the new year play a show or two. Like sometimes the guy at King Cobb really likes me.
Yeah. Well, I saw you there the first time, I think, and that was it's a cool venue for what you do. I think it fits the whole style.
Yeah, but you know, maybe later on in the You know, more towards spring, I think, because, you know, you're playing right beside the door and like the door doesn't close properly. And, you know, so you get these blasts of like January air would be sort of, I don't know. I think I'd rather play there in April.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
We'll see. Yeah.
If people are hearing about you for the first time on this podcast, what's the best way to find out what you're doing as far as, you know, potential upcoming shows or new music?
Okay.
I mean, they could hear it the day it comes out. They could hear it 5 years from now. Where would you direct them?
I would direct them to at Uncle Sinner Music on Instagram. I use Instagram far more than any other social media. Like, I am on Facebook and I'll announce stuff on Facebook, but I just... I tend to use Instagram more because that, as a musician, it has more like other musicians where I can, you know, I see stuff that interests me or other artists, you know. I just, I find it's a good, and I'm not trying to plug it, like, if it's, sorry, I sound like a fucking commercial, but anyways, that's the one that I use the most for whatever reason.
Okay,
it's the best place. Even if it sucks, it's the one I use the most.
No, fair enough. I'm on there a lot, yeah. Too, more than I'd like to be, but yeah, I get it. Are the previous albums, are they still in print? Like, I mean, I'm thinking just in terms of the physical copies, right? Because I know there's probably a lot of people who like what you do, who I'm assuming also like physical media. Are those still floating around, or are you sort of running low on a lot of them?
Well, I had, because people really liked the second album, I had 25 more made when I had this one made. So like, and there's now, you know, 22 copies of Let the Devil In for sale. And those you can only buy through Bandcamp. The other ones, I think Bandcamp might have those as sold out. That's not to say that I don't have a couple of copies,
yeah, yeah.
But, those are situations where, like, if you really want a copy, just drop me a line and I'll see if I can locate one for you.
Cool. And then obviously they exist, like you said, on streaming, and so people can still hear them even if they don't find a, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you can always download them on lossless, wave file on, if that makes sense to people, on Bandcamp, and then you could burn your own CD and it would be just as good.
Yeah.
You just wouldn't have like the art or, liner notes. Like the little booklets actually are what end up costing a lot of money. Like a booklet will cost you like $5 per CD when the CD itself and the, you know, cover is $5. So
yeah. But that's where the important stuff is. I mean, that's like, especially with something like what you're doing, where a lot of these songs have this history, right? Getting like, you know, just saying it's a traditional song or saying who,
yeah,
you know, that's important, I think. But I mean, a lot of people will just happily listen to something without having that. So,
Well, and my Bandcamp page is really, I try to be very conscious of saying like, these are the sources that I use for that, because like otherwise I'm appropriating someone else's work, you know, like even if it is a traditional song,
yeah.
My version might be a blend of, you know, this player and this player's version, and plus, you know, some original touches of my own. But I always try and give credit where possible.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess the last thing I want to ask you too is about this new record, the cover art. I mean, like, you were just talking about liner notes and the album covers and the importance of that stuff. It's a very striking image. I think it fits the music very well. I guess what goes into sort of on your end determining what you're going to use for a cover for a record like this?
Yeah, so I didn't have any ideas for an album cover, but I have like a hobby of driving around Manitoba and sometimes Saskatchewan and poking around like abandoned houses for, not to steal anything, but just to take pictures as like a sort of imaginary archaeology. Anyway, so my son said, well, what about these pictures that you'd taken like at this former homestead in Grahamdale, which is like up in the northwestern Interlake. This guy named Armand Lamise has all these concrete sculptures, and many of them are smashed,
okay,
and vandalized, but a few of them are intact, and they're all very interesting. And he was another outsider artist, you know, he was just doing it for the sake of doing it, and he was told actually that he tried to donate it, and he was told that his work had no cultural value, which was pretty brutal.
That's harsh.
Anyway, so like Dylan, you know, showed me a couple of pictures I'd taken of the devil sculpture and stuff like that, and I was like, yeah, we should do that, but we should do that at night with a torch. And so I had to figure out how to make a torch so that we could light it so there'd be darkness in the background, and that's how that happened. We ended up having to like, it didn't happen till like 11:30, because, you know, even a couple of hours north of Winnipeg in July, it takes quite a while to get dark.
Yeah.
I
like how you I like how you DIY'd that and also did it in a very analog kind of way. It works for sure for your whole aesthetic.
Yeah, and it's film, like it's film pictures, you know, and it's just like a broom handle and a cotton rag that I've stapled and poured kerosene on, you know, and we didn't have a lot of time because that rag burns up pretty quick. So, you know, we did our best and we ended up getting usable photos. So it worked out.
Very cool.
Trimmed and burning, the world is almost gone.